Optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
Lee Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our body from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS. This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self-experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5-Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free. It's always going to be free. And you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5-Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company. It's a lot of fun. 5-Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5-Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you. Hello, boys and girls. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job to deconstruct world-class performers, whether they are chess prodigies, military strategists, former generals, entertainment icons, athletes, or otherwise. And this episode, I am speaking with a friend I hadn't caught up with in a very, very long time, Joshua Skeynes. And that was my dog yawning in the background, otherwise known as Josh Skeynes, Skeen, depending on who you ask, S-K-E-N-E-S, Instagram at J Skeynes, has become famous for his use of fire. As chef owner of Cezanne in San Francisco, which has 3 Michelin stars, one of the very first restaurants ever in San Francisco to receive 3 Michelin stars, he has classical training, which of course you would expect, and loves his high-end Japanese Nenohi knives. Check them out. But nothing quite captures his imagination like the open flame. The back of his business card sports three words, stark on its ivory stock, play with fire. That's what the back of his business card says. And in this episode, we explore three of his obsessions, simplicity, food, and the martial arts. We became friends first during collaboration for the 4-Hour Chef, where he taught me about all sorts of incredible things. And this was a long overdue catch up over lots of different types of tea. So I hope you very much enjoy it. And if you have not yet checked out 5 Bullet Friday, every Friday I send out a free short email, 5 bullets of the coolest things that I have found, discovered, uncovered that week, then you should check it out. It is free and has 70%+ open rate. So people are loving it. It is found at 4hourworkweek.com/Friday, all spelled out, 4hourworkweek.com/Friday. And without further ado, here is Joshua Skaines. Joshua, sir, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It has been so long since we actually hung out.
Yeah, it's been too long. And in fact, it's been probably, 5 years, really?
Probably that we've actually spent any sit-down time together, because the way we connected originally with the, when I was doing research for the 4-Hour Chef and visiting the older location of Saison, brings back a lot of memories. And before I get to that, though, I want to know, do you still have, what does the back of your business card currently say?
I haven't picked up a business card in like 4 years.
So maybe I got the older version.
Yeah, no, I think it used to, I think the one you're talking about used to say play with fire.
Play with fire.
Play with fire was the old one. That was some, one of the guys who does, his name's Jim Ailes, really, really, you know, amazing creative designer, does all the stuff for the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And he thought we should write play with fire on the back because that's what we do.
And we're going to get into a number of different facets of our shared interests. Of course, we're sitting in my house. It's filled with Japanophile paraphernalia everywhere, saddles and armor and whatnot. And at the
completely different from my house.
Completely. But at the first location that I visited of your restaurant, you had a wooden man right there. About, I would say, what, 15 feet from where you did.
From where you seat people. Yeah.
From where you seat people.
we used to throw a blanket, like a little cashmere blanket, and I just covered up from the guest. But, you know, we started leaving it uncovered, and you know, it's very interesting to see people's reactions. They loved it.
So the martial arts and the cooking seem to go back a long way. What are your earliest memories of either?
Well, martial arts, I mean, that I've been doing that for as long as I can stand. So I don't, you know, my earliest memories are, you know, like 4 years old in the backyard, you know, my friend's kicking me or something in the stomach. I don't know if we've got an argument. But in cooking, it's kind of the same way. I don't know. You know, there was really no, there's no direct, path to, starting cooking. You know, I have pictures of me when I had, I was probably, I don't know, 4 with a little chef's hat on, floppy Chef Boyardee hat, and mud pies. So it was always something that was maybe of interest to me. And I can't, you know, this is a super common question, I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. And I can never answer it really properly because I have no idea. It was just always there.
But it was ever present. I mean, in the sense that you grew up in Florida, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just an interest, right? Mm-hmm. We're drawn to things as humans sometimes, and that happened to be something I was drawn to.
Mm-hmm. When were you formally introduced to a specific martial art?
I think I was 6 or so, and that was Tang Soo Do.
No kidding.
My hometown of Florida, yeah. Yeah, and I started with Tang Soo Do, and, you know, my parents got me into it. I think I'd always been into it. I'd expressed some desire. And so, and then from there, Taekwondo. And then from there, I went to, Northern Chinese martial arts and went to Changchun and you know, the various things from there. So I'd done it, you know, off and on and jumped around from martial art to martial art. So there's so many different ones that I toyed with.
And the play with fire, to return to that for a second, How do you use fire in your restaurant? Because that was one of the things that really drew me to engaging with you when I was looking at sort of cooking as a metaphor for learning, but also life in a way, because you're exploring all of these different senses. And when I visited your restaurant, I brought a friend of mine, Jeffrey Zarofsky, who's run many different restaurants, worked as a line cook in many very well-known restaurants. And he said it was one of the, it could have been the intoxication of the 80s music that was being played at the time. Could have been the wine pairings, but he said it was one of his top, I think, three meals that he'd ever had. And the fire.
Oh, we're not doing very good then. We got to get that up to the top.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
And the fire always struck me. How do you use fire and why do you use it so much?
Well, I mean, how is every way, but why I think is, I mean, literally everything on the menu has been touched by fire somehow. And, there's so many different ways that we've kind of explored cooking with fire. It's not all barbecue. It's not all grilled. It's all, these kind of, just ways that we've come up to cook with that are based on, what the product needs, right? I think really great cooking is based on what the product needs. So mm-hmm. if you get a fish in one day, it has a certain taste, a certain texture, a certain, amount of moisture inside. The next day it changes. So you have to change your cooking based on that. So we approach, the fire the same way, to really, base it around finding, great products, amazing products, kind of the best thing in local existence. And then employing a technique that makes those products better, right? But they still wind up as what they are. So that's just in taste in general. And that's, temperature, texture, and flavor. So
let's talk about just state of freshness for a second, because this is also something that you made me think a lot about. And for those people who hear what sound like coffee mugs, that's exactly what you're hearing. So Josh is armed with a half glass, half bowl, a mug full of green tea and black tea. And I have some as well. But the question of freshness. So I was reading about, and I've never seen you do this, but ikejime and like the going through a traditional Japanese butchering process from live fish to using pretty much every component of said fish, right? Which is an art form in and of itself. People tend to assume fresh is always what you want. How would you educate them, or what are your thoughts on the subject? Because you also, just to, I guess, provide some of the punchline, I mean, age a lot of different types of food.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, so you have to look at it like this. Everything has its moment when it tastes its best. And so it really becomes about understanding products and then learning, what period of time those products are best in. And so, for some fish, like a big, fatty fish, it's not right after you kill it. Let me take that back. It's actually a little complicated. It's one of two things generally for fish. Like, as soon as you pull it out of the water, you kill it, you hack off a slice and you eat it right then and there within the first 30 minutes. It's kind of like hunting, right? Like you have a window, like you can eat it within the first 30 minutes or so and it's really great. It's still tender, hasn't set into rigor mortis yet. Or you can really take it, into its sweet spot. And that can be, a week, a day, 6 months even for some things. It just really depends on the product.
What about, I was going to say pigeons, but I guess I should say squab. Do you age squab?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You do, right?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the time of year. It depends on the diet. And that's the whole understanding of products things is you have to really kind of, get a grip on what they're eating, how much fat is in the meat. If you shot it and, a BB went through the breast, then you probably shouldn't age it. You should probably eat it the next day or something. So there's a lot of factors that contribute. I would say 2 weeks on a squab.
Yeah.
Or a pigeon, either one.
And let's talk about the hunting for a second, because we're sitting here and right to my left, your right on this couch, there's a caribou mounted on the wall. Which, some people could actually see and might have seen on a show called Meat Eater. I actually went with a guy named Steve Ranella, who's also...
I saw that. That's the caribou.
That's the caribou.
That's awesome. Yeah.
An avid cook.
Yeah. I love that show.
Wouldn't consider himself a chef, but he's actually a really good cook.
Yeah.
And he took me on my very first hunt, which was white-tailed deer in South Carolina. And I always grew up with a very negative association with hunting because on Long Island, where I grew up, you would find just beer cans littered all over the place and injured deer on our property and across the street and so on. There's just a lot of negligent hunting. But Steve showed me a very different side.
Long Island? No.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? the responsible denizens of Strong Island. But and I'm sure there are great hunters on Long Island also. But the point being that Steve showed me a very different, diametrically opposed, responsible approach and took me through the entire process of field dressing and whatnot. And my experience was with the white-tailed deer, which I felt no guilt about whatsoever. And actually, this right here, and those who don't have a visual, because you wouldn't, I'm picking up a tanned skin that's over the side of my couch is from that first deer. So I want to make these into gloves, but we used everything. We also have Chester, who is Joshua's dog here, a little Frenchie with a brindle coat.
And his hunting collar. That's his
and his
collar.
Hunting collar.
It's my bird dog. It's pretty vicious. You gotta be careful sometimes.
When did you start hunting when you were really young, or did it come in?
Yeah,
later?
I mean, I did in the woods. I never picked up a gun to hunt until I was just a couple years ago, and so up until then, let's go back to Florida. Growing up in Florida, you know, you're just surrounded by swamps and alligators and wildlife in general. You know, you spend most of your time in the woods somewhere, you know, whether it's a park or the woods or something. So you just can't help it. I mean, kids are, especially being a kid there growing up, there's like, I think it's might be the most dangerous place on earth besides maybe Australia. And, I mean, there are alligators, crocodiles. I think it may have the highest variety of poisonous snakes in America. Big water moccasins, huge rattlesnakes, alligator gar, you know, alligator gar, fish that look like, you know, alligator mouth that grow 10 feet long, snapping turtles that can take your hand off, and just all kinds of other shit, like giant spiders. So you can't help but kind of be in the woods and hunt and, you know, rummage around and gather. And my dad was always big into that. So yeah, that's how I grew up. And he would take me over to this, he had a Native American friend of his, named Silver Fox. And so there was always this ethos of, you know, using what you kill and hunting, you know, ethically and, or fishing or just doing anything ethically, right? Being in the woods, kind of being one with nature. So that's how I grew up. And, you know, the product side of that has always been a part of my cooking and part of my thought process. And in fact, I went, you know, from that to the big city to being vegetarian to being, or pescatarian to vegetarian to vegan. And then finally back to hunting again, after becoming chef. So.
What led you out? Was there any particular moment that led you out of veganism or realization or?
Taste. You know what it was? Actually, I just remember I was training again. I took a brief moment off of training when I went to school.
And this was FCI?
Yeah, the French Culinary Institute. It used to be called back then. It's now called the ICC or something.
Right.
And back then it was a bunch of crazy old French dudes, some very well-known French chefs.
In New York City.
Yeah, in New York City. And so I went into school being kind of a vegetarian in culinary school.
That's
and
tough.
I remember tasting this meat and I was like, God, this is fucking disgusting. This is like, you know, like it, because it's commodity veal, right? You're talking about, you know, feedlot cows and stuff. And that's really nasty stuff. And, so the point was, is that I had a dream one night and I was vegetarian at that point, not vegan anymore. And I was in a river. I was standing in a river and I just reached down in and I grabbed a giant squid out and I just bit into it and bit a big hunk of the squid out. And so then I woke up and the next day I woke up and I had this craving for salt and pepper squid. And so I went and got salt and pepper squid and it was the best thing I've ever eaten. And that's how I got out of it.
And that was it.
Yeah.
that was the gateway.
Yeah.
At the time you were training in Bagua, or what were you training in?
Bagua.
Can you describe that for people who are not familiar?
So the typical path to Chinese martial arts as a kid, when you start very young, you start in, like long fist, right? Which is a normal, either southern or northern, you know, you pick what's best for your body type. If you have longer, you know, limbs, then usually long fist is the way to go. And then you can kind of choose after you do that for your years of basics. And once you get through your years of basics, which, you know, take, you know, 10 years or so, then you can kind of start to choose what you want to really kind of specialize in or what you have aptitude towards, depending on, you know, not just your body type, but also your sensibility and your movement. And so I chose internal martial arts, which is the family of, three, Taiji, Xingyi, and Bagua. And so I chose all three of those, right? And I started, in Taiji because my teacher in Florida, was a student of Chen Shaowang. And, Chen Shaowang is a really amazing Taiji teacher from, Chen Village in China. And I just traced up the lineage from there. So when I left Florida in high school, I just traced the lineage back and started doing Xingyi and Bagua. And Bagua was always very interesting to me. And then I just specialized in Bagua. And then when I moved out, that was, I don't know, 10 years before I moved here. And I moved here about 12 years ago. And then I moved out here and I traced my lineage back to the last surviving member of Fu style Bagua. And his name was Liang Xiangya. And he just passed away a couple years ago. But I studied with him for about 10 years until his death.
And
I was supposed to describe Bagua, right?
Yeah.
So Bagua, I mean, you know, it's one of those, it's kind of this esoteric martial art, and it's really hard to describe. I don't know that there's a two sentence description for Bagua, but if I could, it would be evasion. And I think it's kind of the art of evasion, but there's all these kind of prerequisites to that. And I think that it's really hard, even more hard to describe, because most of our understanding in America of really high level Chinese martial arts is total garbage.
Right.
There's almost, I don't know if there is even one, to be honest with you. I mean, you could probably count them on your hands, right?
Right.
To get really good Chinese martial arts that would be effective. But in terms of, you know, healthfulness, it's a really amazing thing. Mm-hmm. So you kind of walk in circles until you get dizzy, and then you're no longer dizzy anymore. And then you learn how to do these little patterns where you go back and forth and up and down. It teaches you basically to have a very supple, strong, flexible, series of movements that can, react at any time to someone else's movements and kind of almost confuse them, if you will, mm-hmm. or just evade just enough to where you always have the angular upper hand.
Because when I've thought of Bagua, and I know very little about it, even though I lived in China for 6 months in 1992 and went to two universities there in Beijing, where I studied something called Da Cheng Quan for a period of time.
Did you go to Beida or where'd you go?
No, I went to, there's one called, oddly enough in English, Beijing Normal University, which is Beijing Shifan Dashi. And then there's Beijing Capital University of Business and Economics, which is Shoudu Jingmao Dashi, but they call it the, Jingji Maoyi Dashi. So those were the two. And with Bagua, I remember seeing someone practicing, and I guess is eight. I don't know what it refers to, but there's some relationship to, what are they? The trigrams of,
well, the Bagua is basically like, is the eight trigrams, right?
Yeah, the eight trigrams.
And so somehow this relates back to, a philosophy, of, you know, the beginning of everything. It's a binary system essentially, to where there's, you know, the void. It all starts with Wuji, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the void, and then there's one and zero and one binaries. And then it builds from there. And I don't really know. That wasn't my purpose for studying things. I never understood it, and I still don't today. Right. So
the cosmology aspect of it. How has, if it has, the martial arts affected how you think about food, cooking, or vice versa?
I think it affects everything. I think it affects the way that you really think and act and everything you do. And I mean, you know, the, just overall, the ability to be more peaceful with your surroundings. But I think that, In cooking, I think it's the essential nature, right? We're a restaurant. I mean, if you were to ask me what Saison is, I would say it's a restaurant. What kind of restaurant? Well, it's American food, because there's no, you know, I think, and that's the part where martial arts kicks in, because you're not, it's meant to be, the essential parts of things, right? In life, and where you're stripping away all of the unessential to get to the essential, right?
Right.
And so that may be, you know, taste, maybe the actual dish itself in the restaurant, where you just have what's essential on the plate. You have a beautiful piece of wild, you know, deer or elk or whatever it may be, one that I hunted in a good place at the right time of year. And you just age it just enough to get to its sweet spot, and you just barely grill it, and you just put a beautiful sauce on the plate, right? And that's the essential part of what pleasure is, right? That's the same with the service, right? I mean, here is the description. It's very simple. It's very basic. We want to get in, give the person their food, get out, let them have a pleasurable experience, right? So all of it is kind of reflected. The whole philosophy of the restaurant and everything else is reflected through, you know, those kind of principles. I think that's very martial arts, right?
Oh, it is. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the, you know, there are parallels in all these things. And the reason, part of the reason I wanted to have you on is because I know you have this deep love and obsession with the Chinese martial arts and internal martial arts. And so I've been fantasizing in part myself of doing a, sorry, I just keep laughing because Josh's dog, like a prairie dog, keeps popping up because he wants to get on the couch.
Chester, get up here. I'm going to take a picture of this.
And, but I've been fantasizing about doing a second podcast. I don't think I'm going to, called Side Gig, because I think that what we do as the primary activity, as people view it, is so informed by what other obsessions we might have, and vice versa. So the question of reducing and simplifying, I think, transfers across all these different areas, right? You look at people who are really world-class as athletic coaches. There's one track and field coach I remember. I think he was Dutch, who said, you know, do as little as is necessary, not as much as is possible, right? And you could apply that to your food. You could apply that to Bagua.
Anything, really. I think in life, yeah.
Sorry
to destroy your couch.
No, that's all right. Chester's having a nervous breakdown. What do you think has made Saison unique and successful as a restaurant?
Well, I mean, I think that at the end of the day, it was about that. Actually, that just the philosophy, the ethos of the restaurant, and because, you know, it started with just the food.
Yeah.
You know, asking myself, you know, a series of questions about what I thought about the food and the quality and the essentialness of everything. And I think that triggered everything else. And that was, you know, really starting and saying, okay, you know, before we even started Saison, it's really just my thought process about, how to create good food. And is this, let's say I'm making a dish and I eat it and I get to it and I say, is this really the best version of this thing that I've ever eaten or ever put in my mouth? And if the answer, it's either yes or no. And the answer is no, then I have to start over and I have to really think through, the reality of what, and just keeping yourself grounded and thinking. And what is the reality of if, you know, Mr. Joel Robuchon came in or something, what would he say? Or what would the best chef in Japan say? You know, and so that, it was that kind of process that I think is certainly influenced by martial arts. And that's how it all started, I guess.
How have you responded when, what is your internal dialogue or self-talk like when you get, say, a review from a critic that you wish were better?
We don't get those anymore, but I hear you from
looking. No.
Or
when you get, I want you to correct my timeline if I'm wrong, but so let's, I'm going to use my flawed memory to try to just paint a picture here. So we connected when you were at the old location, much smaller location. We kept in touch, hit it off. You ended up then developing the new location, which I wanted to invest in purely. And this is the only time, I don't know if I ever told you this, this is the only time I've ever done it where I made the investment viewing it like, this is going to sound silly maybe, but a patron grant in a way, because I enjoyed your work so much. I just wanted to see what you would do next. And so it's like, I cared more about you being able to continue to experiment and refine what you were doing than I cared about ever seeing that come back. Now, the restaurant's done extremely well, but that was the reason for doing it. And then I remember at one point it wasn't a bad review, but it wasn't like a flawless review that came out. And we had a little bit of communication, and you didn't really say anything, and you just went heads down. And then it was like maybe a year later that you became, is it one of the two restaurants ever to receive 3 Michelin stars in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, yeah.
In San Francisco.
So we were the first along with one other restaurant.
Yeah, Bennu, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And when you get either an imperfect review or a great review, what do you say to yourself?
Well, I mean, you know, reviews are you know, the whole media is, it's a great validation in some ways to hard work. But at the end of the day, you know, if those things didn't exist, you know, asses in the seats are really what make you enjoy your life, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for that reason, it's just, you have to just, I mean, there's learning tools there. You know, you get a bad review, then you have to really think about it. You gotta really, is this really true? You know, it's important to, you know, take in what's real and discard what's not, right? Mm-hmm. Because, we know the media is, they can be a little silly sometimes. Yeah. So, or inaccurate, let's say. But there is also a lot of really knowledgeable people out that have traveled the world. And I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't think about it anymore. Yeah. I don't think about it anymore because, when I see people come in the restaurant and really have such an amazing time, that's what's kind of special to me. That's what makes it worth it. It's very, you know, simple in a way. And I'm a simple dude in many ways.
I remember the first time I did I'm not sure if I would call it a chef's table. I think it was a chef's table dinner at Cezanne, and there were a couple of simple, and I was looking for things that I could share in the 4-hour chef, right? Things that people could try, test themselves. And one of them was so simple, but so well done. And I want you to describe it. I don't remember the name, but it was effectively a piece of cling wrap on top of not a martini glass, but a very nice piece of glassware.
Oh, the magic bowl.
There we go.
The magic bowl.
The magic bowl. Can you describe this? And then a piece of food suspended on top.
So it's just like, it's been around for a long time, but it's basically just, you stretch a piece of saran wrap over the top of a glass bowl, or any bowl really for that matter, where basically you stretch it far enough around the edges so that when you rip it off, the top seems like it's floating on air, right? So you can't really tell that there's saran wrap there. And, people love that.
And then
it looks like the food's floating. You put a piece of food on top of the saran wrap, it looks like the food's floating.
Yeah. But it's a very, I'd never seen
now it. Now I think it's totally ridiculous and I would never do it again.
Well,
it was fun though.
At the time it was fun. So what are you experimenting with these days? What are you most excited to work on or experiment with?
It's products, you know, as time goes on, you know, just like if you practice your martial arts over and over again, you do that one throw, you know, millions of times if you can. And then that's when it really starts to get interesting. It's the same way with cooking. Like you repeat the same process over and over and over again, thousands and thousands of times. And you start to, you know, get a little better understanding of it. And then another few thousand times go by, you start to get a little more better understanding of it. And then maybe you start to look at your products a little differently. You start to chase down better products. You're, you know, a little bit less salt, more natural flavor comes out. You know, it's such subtle little differences. But that's really what makes up really, really great cooking, is just all of those little tiny things done really well throughout a process that you've repeated, you know, thousands and thousands of times.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me think of Bruce Lee, right? I mean, and I'm going to butcher the quote, but along the lines of, I don't fear the man who's practiced 10,000 kicks one time each. I fear the man who's practiced one kick 10,000 times.
Right, exactly. Well, that's really what it's about, because that's from martial arts. I mean, you know, the more I talk about it, the more it comes back to really just martial arts and practicing. Because we used to, when I was young, we would practice the same throw for hours and hours and hours again. It was just do that throw over and over and over again. That's all we did and do until we could just do it no matter what, right? Until it's default, until it's, you know, you go through those isolation drills where you basically isolate everything that you do in your arsenal. And then you do it so many times that it's there when you need it, no matter what.
Right.
Right? That's same with cooking, right? Same with anything, I guess.
Make it part of your on-demand repertoire.
Yeah. What's that?
Make it part of your on-demand repertoire.
Yeah.
Like you can call it when you need it.
Yeah.
So of the, if you were to think of some of the biggest influences, or mentors, they don't have to be from cooking, but, in your sort of development as a chef, as a cook, who are some of the names that come to mind or people who come to mind?
You know, that, I don't know. It's a great question. I mean, you take influence from everywhere. This is another question that happens sometimes that I can't ever answer.
I'm sure there are a ton of them, but I'm not going to let you go with they're everywhere. I'm going to,
they are everywhere,
I'm looking for any specific lessons learned. So for instance, I'll give you an example. One of my friends who used to work at, one of Danny Meyer's very first restaurants. No, it wasn't at Danny. Well, he did do that, but he worked with this very famous French chef at one point, and he ended up teaching this guy, Jeffrey, how to move through the kitchen without being underfoot and like getting in the way of everyone else. And he would always say to him, he'd go, Jeffrey, you are like my dick, always between my legs. And he would yell at him. But that is one of the lessons that he learned, was just how to navigate moving between line cooks and so on. Right. So like, In the school of hard knocks,
I'm like running through my head right now to try to find an example. And you know, I think what the problem is with me is that I don't remember shit. My memory is absolutely terrible. And in many ways, because I think that my process is, feelings and shapes. And, you know, here is an image that triggers a memory.
Mm-hmm.
Here is a, you know, a feeling that creates a thought. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the same for everybody. I don't know, but maybe it's just that my memory really sucks.
It could be.
But if I could look at mentors, then it would have to be probably one of my first martial arts teachers in Florida, in Chinese martial arts. His name is Cam Lee. And he was this guy who was just, you know, he's shorter, stockier dude, and he would just practice everything that he preached. He was a living example of everything real around him, and truthful and kind of sincere and honest. But he was also, you know, real badass on the side. Like he could just throw you to the ground. It just, right. There was just no, but he wouldn't ever unless you're training. Right. And so, he just embodied this kind of peacefulness and healthfulness and patience and all these things. And I don't know, I lost the patience a long time ago, so I didn't really do well with that example. But in many ways, you know, I still look back to him, you know, all the time, just based on those simple, you know, kind of simple examples that he provided that are, you know, simple to say but really hard to do.
Yeah.
You know.
What have been some of the toughest times for you, professionally or personally?
Opening Saison was both a great time and a really tough time. In the beginning, I mean, we were in an alley, right? When we started, it was one day a week. And we started it because, I was unhappy in my, you know, consulting job that I was doing. I wound up being broke after spending all my money in 2007 or whatever it is. I, you know, 2007 was a very kind of a prosperous year, for money for me. And I made a bunch of money, but then I thought it was just going to keep coming. And then all of a sudden everything crashed. I was like, oh shit, I screwed this one up. So I said, you know, if I'm going to be broke, I'd rather be happy and broke than, you know, miserable and broke. And so that's why I started Saison. It gave me kind of like courage to just say, you know what, fuck it. I'm just going to jump out on my own here and just do what I really want to do, what I really believe in. And that started as just a simple thing, one night a week, you know, in an alley, really, right?
Now, the one night a week, was that because you were renting the space from someone else just for once a week and that's what you could afford? Or was it that that was the only way you could really prepare?
Well, there's no deposit, so that's why we could afford it.
Yeah.
No, but we started with like 10 grand, right? Mm-hmm. Of our own money. It was $10,000 and that was it. There was one opening in this event space, which was the old Saison, and we just, you know, Sunday nights at Saison. We started Sunday nights at Saison. I just wanted to cook again. So we bought some pots, we bought some plates, and we
jumped into it.
Yeah.
What were the hardest experiences in those first few months for you?
Oh, right. So to get back to your original question, you know, we started this thing inside a cafe, I'm sure they're going to be very angry once I expose all this, but, there's this cafe and they just had really bad practices and we, you know, worked out a deal to where we would do, you know, our Sunday nights, but they would always get in the way, or like some of their workers would come in and just like touch our food and shit that we spent 3 months, you know, trying to perfect.
Oh my God.
Or we had, you know, like we would have like these beautiful like ferments that we made from like 3 years ago.
What are ferments?
Well, just like, oh, pickles, like fermented, or something. Fermented. Let's say foods, pickles, right, or something. It. You got a pot of pickles in the backyard that I've had for, you know, 7 years that have been aging carefully and now they're amazing. And then, you know, you got this knucklehead coming in and like spilling shit on top of them.
Oh God.
And the dish pit was shared. So the dish where the dishwashing happened was shared between the old Saison and the cafe, and it was just a nightmare. And the place would flood every year with sewage water, and we had to rip everything out, throw everything away, start over. It was like the most volatile place ever. You know what's funny about that is that the day that we were moving out, you know, we got all our investments to move to the new location. That was like 4 years ago now, I think. And the day that we were moving out, we had finished service for the night, you know, great last service. We hired movers. Everybody came in, packed everything up, and it was probably 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. by then. And we're just waiting, and, we fell asleep. I fell asleep on the, you know, on the stool outside, just waiting for the movers to show back up because they needed to go get breakfast or something. They were supposed to just take all the shit. And then all of a sudden I woke up to somebody screaming, shit, it's flooding. There's fucking water everywhere. And within 15 minutes, whatever the system was on Folsom Street is really the worst infrastructure in all of San Francisco. And within 15 minutes, we were under 3 feet of water back there because there was a gradient and it went down. And, you know, from the street level was approximately 2 or 3 feet higher than the back of the restaurant. And so all of our stuff that we packed up was completely soaked in sewage water. We got pictures of like Mark Bright, you know, the sommelier, floating on a barrel, on a wine barrel out in there, you know, with a little lasso in his hands that he made. Just, it was ridiculous. So that was how we ended, that's how we ended the old space. And, we just threw everything out and started over.
So in a situation like that, so catastrophe strikes, how do you contend with that mentally yourself? I mean, is there a person you call? Do you just go fucking, hey, smash on the wooden man for 17 no. hours straight? What do you do?
I just, it's all internal. I was just thinking to myself, you know, I was just kind of exasperated because I lost all my old books from like culinary school.
Oh man.
Like every note that I'd ever taken for 10 years or so or 15 years was in that flood. Like all of my notes, my moleskins.
That's my
little
worst nightmare.
All of the ideas of like any thing that was truly unique to my thoughts.
You sound like me. I've just got like bookshelves of notebooks.
Yeah. So all those just gone in sewage. And all the ink was running on them. And I was like, everything else is replaceable. But that was really truly the thing where I looked at it and I was like, fuck, I just had to sit down for a while. And we're moving into new space. So there's a positive spin. I was like, you know, fuck it. We're just going to start over. And, it's the same thing that we started with. It's all up there somewhere. I know not those exact things, but you just got to start over.
Well, I remember, something very similar happened to a guy I had on the podcast recently named Cal Fussman. So Cal is one of the most masterful interviewers I've ever met. He did the What I've Learned series, probably, I don't know, 60% of it for Esquire magazine. So he's interviewed everybody, like Gorbachev, Clooney, like you name it. It's everybody. And at one point he'd been working on this piece for like a year and a half, and it was in the basement of some, I think, relative's house, and then it flooded and he lost all of his notes for a piece he'd been working on for a year about becoming for a day a sommelier on top of the World Trade Center, because it was because 9/11 happened and like interrupted everything. Of course, I mean, huge tragedy. He wasn't sure he should even work on it. And the advice that he was given by, I guess it was a mentor, who just said, the good shit sticks. It's like, sit down and write it. He's like, the good shit sticks. Did you, what were the best decisions that you made with the new space? So in a way, I mean, you get this flood, notes are gone. You're starting from, I mean, scratching away, right? You have to get, you have to buy.
I think it was starting over, actually. I think the best decision I made was just to say, okay, screw it. Let's really start over. Let's just completely empty our cup here and really, think about now and what is really valuable. You know, what's really valuable to me now? What's honest? What's sincere about what we're doing? And let's do that. And that's really, still the driver to Saison now.
When you have people come in, when you hire people to cook at the restaurant.
Really, Chester keeps farting right in my face.
Right in your left armpit.
He's a passionate little puppy. Yeah.
Very passionate. Yeah. He's out cold.
So this, he looks kind of like a little pork chop, and there is, I went pig hunting. Yeah. I go all the time, but I went,
in last month up north and here
in out like to the west of Red Bluff near Mendocino National Forest.
Got it.
And there are pig dogs, on one of the hunts, and they were all in the truck. And so we were walking by, I walked by with Chester, and they thought he was a pig, I think, because they were going fucking crazy in there, and they were barking at him, and he stopped and looked, and he looks kind of like a little,
he does,
pig,
does, you know? Look like, yeah, a little porker. Pork chop.
But anyway,
so when you bring someone in, you have a very, very high level, or you have a very, very high standard at Saison. What training or pep talk or anything do you do with these people?
We give them the silent treatment as soon as they walk through the door, basically.
You give them silent treatment?
Silent treatment. To see if they're going to crack, yeah.
Okay, so.
No, I'm just kidding. We don't. I do, but my staff doesn't. Yeah. And my team doesn't. I guess in terms of training, you know, there is, I went through a long period of just like the old school, you know, mentality of like, zero patience, you know, kind of here's why, you know, I don't know, just that old school, like abusive mentality of cooking.
Yeah, drill sergeant,
you know, that kind of military, ridiculousness, really. Right. Yeah. But that's evolved into over the years of just, you know, going back to kind of the martial arts thing and, you know, just kind of remembering, you know, that patience from my teachers and just from what martial arts does in general. So now it's really like, I like to, you know, if I can create the, you know, the Google of restaurants, then that's really a nice thing, right? It's a great goal for me, in terms of having a really exceptional workplace. And, you know, granted, I don't really know anything about Google at all. So it could be terrible. I don't know, but maybe from the outside, who was it that, I was just listening to somebody talk about, you know, from the outside, everybody's trying to get in, and from the inside, everybody's trying to get out. So, I don't know. I think some podcast or something. But,
yeah, but I can see that. I mean, I know I have a lot of friends at Google though, and it seems to be pretty exceptional.
It's, yeah. So that's really the goal. The goal now is really mentorship and how we can create this kind of like package on the inside to help our team navigate through some really, you know, difficult and enigmatic, you know, environment. Because there's always a gray area when you start at a new place, right? You don't really know, everything that you need to. And even if you are a great cook, let's say, and you start in a new kitchen at a very high level, then there's going to be things you don't know. Every chef has a different way to do things. Every restaurant has a different SOP for something. And so
SOP,
I wanted to create
standard of practice.
Yeah. And standard operating procedure. Yeah. Yeah. And so I wanted to create really this, app essentially. That'll allow people to operate every moment of their day like Subway. Mm-hmm. Subway actually sucks, but, right. but, I got a funny story about Subway later on, I'll tell you. But, and so that it gives people, you know, this huge, you know, influx of information so they can be successful. So that's kind of the way we operate now. We want people to be, mentored through the process. And you know, in return, they develop loyalty to that kind of, you know, patience that you give them.
Right.
And then they wind up, you know, really learning something that's tangible, because I want these guys to come and work for us and, you know, spend a few years there. And it really takes, you know, 5 years or so to really learn about, you know, cooking at a certain kind of cooking, certain level. I don't want to use level because I sound like a dick when I say that, but I just want to use, you know, a certain type of cooking. And I want them to be able to walk away with something really tangible where they can, you know, contribute or recontribute. Mm-hmm.
And, so since you brought it up, Subway, tell me the story.
I don't know. I might go to jail after I tell you the story. I used to work in Subway, and there was always like a little manual, and I was probably 15 when I was 16 probably when I worked there. I don't know if I should tell the story. We
cut it out later if you change your mind. But let's go.
It made me think of Subway because of their manual, operating manual. So my second memory from Subway would be us, learning how to block out the cameras by standing in strategic positions, putting bubble gum on the end of a coat hanger and fishing $100 bills out of the safe in the floor drop. So we did that for about a week, and then I think we all got fired after that. Because nobody knew what happened to the hundies. Yeah. It was like, what happened there?
Wow, that's some real like Ocean's 11 action at Subway. Who knew?
That was my time. So my contribution to Subway.
I've always wanted to ask you, and I've never asked you, what's your opinion of Francis Mallmann, if any? I don't know if you even know who I'm talking about.
I know who you're talking about. I don't know enough about him to really give you my opinion. I saw the Chef's Table episode that he did, mm-hmm. That I thought was really cool. Yeah, I love that series. He's very philosophical.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's cool. It's beautiful to see like what he's doing out there in nature. Obviously he's a legend. He's been around for a long time. I don't know enough about it though to really say anything meaningful, I think it's amazing, you know, looking at like him out in Patagonia and those like just pulling trout out of the lake. And I mean, that for a chef, that's the ultimate, right? Yeah. And I that's actually something I've been working on for years and years, is just to get myself to the woods, just so I could stay in the woods. I can gather, I can hunt, I can fish, I can cook, I can eat, and just be happy. And that's kind of really my goal of happiness, is just to be out there in the woods and just, you know, look, here's a root. I'm going to dig it up and I'm going to cook it and it's going to taste great. And we're going to have some wine together and we're all going to celebrate and have a great time. And that's what I'm looking for. So I don't know. I don't really know enough about him.
I think
he likes to burn shit.
He likes to burn
really
shit. That's why
shit everywhere. I don't like burnt food like that. So
So you don't like the, so you're talking like the charring.
Yeah. Or? I mean, I like food that has a delicacy to it. So it's very like, I like food that is, you know, you got to think in terms of volume, right? If you put on like, what's that, like heavy metal band, like Gwar or whatever.
Gwar, Slipknot.
You turn it, you just pick something like that. You just turn the volume all the way up in the house and you're just, then there's, that's like Guy Fieri, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He's Gwar on level 10. Okay. So then you take, let's just use a restaurant that I really love in the mountains of Kyoto. And they serve all wild foods from around there. Really delicate. The broths are under-seasoned by our Western standards. And, you know, it's all about natural taste. But there's an incredible beauty to that food. Then that's a volume one, right? And so that's really what we're looking for in our world of cooking, right? So I don't like the level 10s. I like the level 2s, you know, around there.
I would love to just be a fly on the wall. Maybe sometime we'll get down to Patagonia and have a couple bottles of Malbec with Francis. But what struck me, there were a handful of cookbooks that really inspired me when I was working on The 4-Hour Chef, which was very confusingly to most people, a book about accelerated learning, kind of disguised as a cookbook. But Seven Fires, which was by Francis Mallmann, because he had the fancy French training, right? But he chose to go back to a lot of basics but like refine them to such a degree that they were highly, highly advanced from a kind of a technical level, right? And then I think it was just Mission Street Food or Mission Chinese, just a beautifully well put together book. A handful of others. There's another one on hunting and foraging from the UK, the name of which I'm blanking on at the moment.
River, maybe? River
Could
Cottage.
Have been. Or, yeah. So the Escape.
Those are cool.
The TV show is what I was my kind of like fantasy escape for a while. The first, I was at Escape from River Cottage or Escape to River Cottage by Hugh Fearnsley Whittingshall. Like the, I think that's his name, the most British name ever. Yeah. Incredible books, but that TV show for people who fantasize about getting out of the city and going back to the land and hunting and foraging and fishing, I highly recommend the first season of that series.
I gotta check that out. I don't know.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. It's so good. Is there, do you gift books to people? Like historically, have you given books as gifts? If so,
yeah.
Any that come to mind?
They're all different. I mean, the one that I just gave out in most recent history was, there's an old, bar book. It's called Cocktail Techniques, and it's from an old. Have you seen that one? It's
no,
a little tiny book, and it's from I think it's the guy from Bar High Five. He's like in Tokyo.
Yeah, sure.
It's just about pure craft and technique.
It's just called Cocktail Techniques.
It's Cocktail Techniques, I think, and I think that's the guy. It could be a different guy, but really cool book. So I just gave those out to a bunch of my staff. The other one is The Art of Tai Chi Chuan. And it's the Tao of Tai Chi Chuan. And, it's by a guy named Zhou Sung Hua, I think his name is. I don't know, something along those lines. But it's a really, it's a really amazing book on Tai Chi. And it has a lot of epiphanies in there because he started, Tai Chi when he was 40 something because of his bad health. So he was like on his deathbed or something along those lines. He got cancer mm-hmm. or something like that. And he apparently, went through, started from being completely unhealthy and then took his journey through Tai Chi to become, one of the foremost experts in America on Tai Chi. And
that's
he traveled
wild.
The world and,
starting at 40.
Yeah.
Or so.
And of course, within a few years, just like everybody else that does Tai Chi, they become fixed essentially more or less, right? As long as you're consistent in your practice, you do it the right way and you practice it for health and I've seen a lot of people over the years, like, car accidents or whatever. That's one of my other favorite books because there's a lot on the application process and the actual martial part of Tai Chi, which is really almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. In China too. And it's still almost non-existent now because everything's kind of sport based ever since I suppose martial arts became inessential once the firearms were created. Then that was the downhill of hand to hand combat, right?
Well, was it
those downward trends?
Like, yeah, it was like in necessity is the mother of invention, right? And it's like once you don't have that as a necessity,
yeah, everybody's like, oh, thank God, I could just shoot this guy. I'm like, I don't have to stand in a horse stance for 18 hours a day.
when you think of the word successful, who's the first person who comes to mind?
I don't have a person. To me, success is living what brings you joy, and I think doing whatever process brings you happiness, I think is what success to me. And that's really all it is, right? Because at the end of the day, it's freedom that matters. And whatever that freedom is to each individual is kind of what's important. So for me, it's just being in the woods. At some point, I'm going to disappear. I'm going to be in the woods.
There'll be I'll see some like the Montana Freeman. I'll just have some holdout skeins. Now I'm embarrassed to say, hold on a second. So I've only heard you say your last name once, and it made me think that I've been saying your last name incorrectly for as long as I've had your name written anywhere in front of me.
Everybody does. My family, we grew up saying it Skeins.
Skeins.
But in Scotland they say Skeen. Skeen is the proper way to say it.
Got it. Scottish. So the silent S.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Or maybe they say Skeens too.
But you say Skeins.
Yeah, we say Skeins. Yeah.
Skeins. For, right. What is the most joy that you've felt in the last 3 months, 6 months, recent memory?
Well, for those last 6 months, I've actually been working on a big deal for the company. And so, it would have to have been last week when I closed the deal because I could finally breathe again. I read so many legal documents in the last 6 months that I feel like I could be a lawyer. It's mind numbing. It just, it's so miserable in every way possible. But it's nice to get it done.
Can you talk about that or not yet?
No, I can't talk about it yet. Okay. There's a lot of exciting stuff to happen here. They're very, very exciting things. And you know, this whole woods thing is something that I've been thinking about for years and years and years because, you know, the fact of the matter is that, to really get to the highest level of your craft of cooking, you need to be submerged in the woods. You need to be surrounded and isolated by the wild, really, to really reach a certain point. It's the water. It's the air. It's the way the air tastes when you're there. It's everything contributes to that. It's the products, of course. So, but that's an ultra geeky level of it. You know, it's like it's only for a handful of people that really enjoy that kind of thing. But I think most people enjoy being in the woods. So
if you could pick anywhere outside of the US to immerse yourself in the outdoors that way, where would you pick?
Outside of the US, I guess, you know, my whole life is just a few things. Besides family, the only thing that I really, you know, give a shit about are martial arts and cooking. Mm-hmm. And it's not just cooking. It's the whole process, the whole act, the whole commune with nature. You know, being out in the wilderness and being able to hunt your own meat. And it's not about the killing. It's about the sustenance that we get and kind of the feeling that we get from being part of that process.
Also, it's just like the consciousness and the reverence in a way of having to go through the entire process.
Yeah, you have to treat things differently once you experience killing another, you know, thing, right? Another living thing, especially when you kill a big animal like an elk and a deer. There's a very different feeling from shooting a bird or something, right? Even though, you know, the bird, I didn't, you know, start doing that stuff until later. So to me, they're all the same. But yeah, you walk away with, you know, as a cook, especially, you know, knowing that you're not going to waste a single piece of anything on that animal. And I think that's very important because a lot of this ties back into a way bigger conversation, which is about, just our commodity food processes in America. And we are full of disease and shit because of the way that we eat and the way we treat our food. You know, there's feedlot cattle and you know, chemically induced, you know, vegetables and crops and you know, most of our food sources now are products that we use on the commercial market or have zero or, you know, almost very little, resemblance to what they originally were. And so, you know, that's even more reason to just go to the woods, get out of here.
So where would you, if you had to pick a spot outside the US to.
Oh, sorry. I missed
that. No, that's okay.
I get off on these tangents.
No, it takes one to know one. So that's, I can realize.
Keep me in line.
I can realize.
you know, I don't know. I was just looking at, British Columbia. My perfect place would be mountain streams where the mountain streams meet the ocean, really, you know, and that's kind of the perfect place where it's, so British Columbia has a lot of that. I want to experience the four seasons. You know, I want to see snow. I want to see the flowers in the spring you know, I want to have, you know, a bear walk through the woods and potentially eat my goat, you know, cause it's, there's a cycle there. There's a cycle of life and a cycle, you know, things that don't exist in a city anymore. And we're so, removed from just everything really in a city in a lot of ways. So, I don't know location wise. I mean, I love.
BC is a good choice.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks amazing up there. I was just looking at buying, there's a hunting territory up there that I wanted to buy. And it was really cheap. And so maybe we can go in on this. There was a 250 square mile hunting territory. And, you know, the center of that was, I think 200 acres or something like that.
Right.
And there's cabins on it. And it's on a lake and the stream and it was $500,000.
Wow.
So you know, I mean, so naturally you're like,
before
okay,
this
you know,
gets, the before this seems, podcast goes out.
Yeah. Let's get out of here.
I dated a very lovely woman whose family was from BC. So I ended up spending quite a lot of time up around Victoria and some of the more sort of rural outskirts of Victoria. stunning. I mean, it's, and we wanted, I mean, you had to be cognizant of bears and so on and so forth. And I spent so much time trying to track down, of course, firearms are very difficult to get a hold of, but this was while I was doing also the sort of refinement on the 4-hour chef, and I wanted to go rabbit hunting. And I spent so much time trying to track down high powered pellet guns. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll
just call me. I like slingshot safe. Yeah.
But, it's a beautiful part of the world. I did a road trip for those people interested with my brother, because I'd done so many trips between San Francisco and LA, right? San Francisco South. I think it's very common. I'd never gone north. So I did a road trip with my brother from San Francisco all the way up the coast to Whistler in Canada, and stopped along the way at all these, you know, lumberjack houses and so on in Oregon, saw the dunes that inspired the book Dune. I think also in Oregon, the Avenue of the Titans and so on.
It's amazing up north. It really is.
Gorgeous. It's gorgeous. People search, yeah. For those people interested, search my last name. There's, I think, Gems of the Northwest or something. I highlight 16 different stops that we made, but,
yeah, there's, I spent a lot of time last fall going up into like Hat Creek and, like all those falls up there. And
oh, so many
waterfalls.
It's amazing
up there. Yeah, it's incredible up there.
A lot
of Shasta, especially up around Shasta. Shasta is apparently like one of the vortexes in the world, whatever that means.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but that's what I heard.
Worth exploring. Yeah. Do you have, what does your morning look like? What are your morning rituals? And let's say not necessarily when you're in like hyper legal due diligence mode, but let's just say when you're not covered in that.
When
kind
I'm
of
at
stuff.
Peace again.
Yeah. What is your morning?
Hong Kong milk tea and Tai Chi, to be honest. That's
what
really
time
good.
Do you wake up?
It's always different. I'm very inconsistent with that. I'm like, one day it'll be 1 p.m. The next day it'll be 5 a.m.
Got it.
It just depends. So but you, I love the morning, and if I had my perfect scenario, it would just be, you know, a cup of tea and some Tai Chi and then, get on with it.
Got it. Do you, what type of tea?
Hong Kong milk tea.
Hong Kong milk tea. What is in
so
Hong
Kong
milk
tea? Is like, there's a mixture of black teas. Every place has their own brew, you know, different types of leaves, could be Darjeeling or Ceylons or whatever. And then you essentially soak it in water and you overbrew it in some ways. There's a very high ratio of leaves to water. And then you mix it with, evaporated milk. Some people put sugar or sweetened condensed milk in there. I just take it straight. But it's something that I grew to love in Hong Kong. And it was just an amazing thing in Hong Kong. It's addictive. It's highly, highly addictive. So that's what I drink in the morning.
And then the Tai Chi, how long would you practice that for? What type of Tai Chi?
You know, I've gone as short as like 37 seconds in some mornings to like, 3 hours. It just depends. Depends on the time. I usually do like a couple sets. Mm-hmm. I do like one set, maybe slow, couple sets. That's it. Yeah. Just to get the blood flowing and to rebalance yourself, because there's a lot of, like, one of the things about doing these forms with the intention of fighting and not with the intention of performance or health, is that you develop a certain kind of like stability in your body and legs. And I've noticed that start to go away over the last few years with just being busy and stuff like that. You can feel it in your knees. Like especially going hunting and stuff, I was like, wow, this would have been super easy, you know, for me a few years ago. But now I feel like fucking Chris Farley. I don't know. It's like the worst. It's really hard. Yeah.
I noticed this, very recently also doing, I mentioned when we were just making tea before we started recording, getting into gymnastics training, which I'm doing with, incredible coach named Coach Chris Sommer, who's the former national team coach. And we're doing, for the first time, I'm doing remote coaching. So I'm sending him videos. He's reviewing. We jump on the phone, et cetera.
That's interesting.
And, one of the series that I've been doing and I need to start doing more consistently is this knee sort of prehab rehabilitation, series. It's all body weight that focuses on strengthening, say the ACL, the cruciate ligaments, et cetera, with these different types of weird looking squats. And I did them for say 3 weeks, just once or twice a week, took maybe 5 minutes each session. And it was incredible how much more stability I felt in my knees doing any type of movement, any type of walking, hiking, jumping. and it highlighted for me that that must mean my knees were fucking unstable as hell beforehand. If like within 2 or 3 weeks, I felt a huge increase in stability, which I guess is a symptom of just sitting down too much.
Also the way we move too, you know, I mean, our Western, you know, patterns of movement, in a lot of ways are not, well, I guess everyone's pattern of movements are not very, they're kind of just like up, down, left, right.
Yeah.
You know, computer, you know, bar.
Yeah. There's not a lot.
Couch, TV.
There's not much lateral. There's not a lot of torsion, of different types. And, you know, rotational exercise is pretty much out the window for most folks. So then when you encounter that in any capacity and it's forced upon you, then you get injured.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say in Bagua, they isolate some movement patterns.
Mind if I have some of your
tea? And it's really just kind of an exercise in balance and being able to, learn, you know, power versus, resistance.
What do you mean by that?
Well, okay. So let's say you are practicing, a stance. Mm-hmm. Let's say just for lack of a better example, without going into too much detail. And that stance, you feel very stable in that stance while you transition to another stance and you're, you know, undulating or rotating or going up and down, changing levels. But that's without pressure, without resistance. So let's say you take that same technique or stance or whatever, and then you pressure test it and apply another human being to push on you or try to throw you while you do that same thing. Mm-hmm. So you basically are pressure testing, you know, the reality of some of these movements. And, you know, you have to, before you do that, you have to have a lot of, you know, time and solo practice with those movements or stances and, you know, repetition and all that stuff. So you actually don't rip your knee out of socket or something. So don't go doing this at home until you practice a little bit. But the thing is that it brings a sense of reality to it, because that's always the problem with Chinese martial arts that you see is there's no reality to a lot of this shit.
It's very silly.
It's never tested under the
circumstances in which you would need to use it.
Yeah. Or against bigger people or against real violence or against any of those things that you would need to actually make something truly effective. But the point was, is that it develops your, you know, all of your connective tissue and all of your body. And I'm pretty sure the only reason that I can still walk is because of my early years of martial arts in all of this kind of stance work and transition work and that kind of like twisting and turning of the body and like Tai Chi and internal martial arts. It's very helpful for the body.
I think there's something there, and my interest in Tai Chi at one point was pretty close to zero, just because I was so focused on the harder fight sports like Muay Thai and so on, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And in the last, say, 5 years, my interest has really been piqued by a friend of mine named Josh Waitzkin, who's been on this. I'll just have like a podcast small world story real quick. So I get this text at one point from Matt Mullenweg, who's I guess he's the CEO of Automattic right now and was one of the lead developers of WordPress. And he goes, I was walking with my girlfriend through New York. It's like Central Park or somewhere. No, it wasn't Central Park. It was near the water. And he said, we saw this guy doing some weird martial arts stuff right on the water. And so I was commenting on it and how it looked really beautiful to my girlfriend. She said, well, you should walk up and say hi. So we walked up and said hi. And it was another person who'd been on the podcast, Josh Waitzkin, doing Tai Chi. Now, Josh was the basis for Searching for Bobby Fischer, this movie about this chess prodigy, which he was when he was a kid. But he's also he was a push hands world champion. And then after that became the first black belt under Marcelo Garcia, who's like the Michael Jordan, Mike Tyson, Wayne Gretzky combined of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I always associated Tai Chi with non-martial applications, right? But he uses this and has prescribed it to his parents, who've seen fantastic results for rehab, prehab, just life stability and well-being in general. So even though he has a tremendous amount of experience with BJJ at an extremely high level, he still does the Tai Chi on a regular basis, which has made me think that there's, that I should probably make space for a practice of that type.
I'll tell you what, there's a lot more to it than you, you know, most people, give credit for, because the reason is that there's no good Tai Chi really anywhere, right? So it's very,
and Josh would agree with you, by the way.
And just imagine, you know, if you had no good, you know, jujitsu anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, then everybody would make fun of it because these guys would just get on the ground and get stomped.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, if it's the same thing, it's the same would apply to any kind of system. And so, but once you, if you really, you know, happen to be lucky enough to stumble upon someone who's truly, really great at the martial side of Tai Chi, then, you know, it's all, it's kind of like this immovable mountain thing. And, you know, my take on it is that in terms of like real, real, applicable martial arts, which means being able to defend yourself against someone who's using real violence. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about sport, right, which is still very difficult, right? I mean, that's not, but to really be able to defend yourself against real violence is a different kind of ball of wax, right? And oftentimes that requires less, less of a lot of things than a sport would, right? You don't need to train for 20 hours a day to be able to get to that point. You don't have to have amazing cardio necessarily. You know, a lot of things go out the window due to this kind of, ability to evade.
Right.
And evasion is not in a large circle. It's really can be a very small thing. Like, let's say you, a simple example would be, let's say that you practice, standing with your knees bent a little bit, to the point to where you would, you know, fall over the first day. And for 20 years, you practice that same kind of standing against somebody trying to push you over. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, eventually you get to the point to where you can't be pushed over. Right. And you went through a series of different opponents and different people trying to, you know, throw you over, but that's all you practice forever. Right. And so Tai Chi develops that kind of skill, right, when it's done in the martial sense. But then you're able to mobilize it. So you, let's say you take the static, you know, starting point of being immovable. Immovable doesn't mean you're actually immovable. It means you're adjusting your body to the other person, right? And to their force that's coming towards you, you're adjusting a little bit, right? And it's not this whole, there's a lot of like, you know, hokey pokey shit out there on people that don't really, that say a right. philosophy, but there's no real applicable, you know, reality to it. So that's one thing. And the other thing is just kind of ability to evade. Like let's say you take, you know, a Thai boxer who, Muay Thai guy who can kick really fucking hard, and a guy who practices kicks every day is a professional Thai boxer. What we have to realize is that the distance, there's just a distancing thing, right? At the point of impact of anybody's kick or punch or attack is one place. Once they release that, you know, intention, once the intention leaves the, you know, the mind and goes into the body and the action is created and it's traveling towards your opponent, there's a target, there's an intended target. If you can change yourself from being that intended target, you know, the origin of that, and reroute yourself only a few inches, then all of that force goes away. Right. Yep. And so, It's a simple kind of thing to say, but, you know, just to be able to do that with one punch or one kick takes a lifetime to learn, right? And I'm not saying I know these things. I'm just saying that there's a couple simple truths that I've learned from it that's a couple. But, so I think that Tai Chi is very applicable because, you know, I go out and practice with, over the years, I've practiced some really amazing MMA guys, some really amazing jiu-jitsu guys. You see a translation from this kind of traditional martial arts, but only very little. It's not like overall, you know, you can't just go get in the cage. You know, it's not so, but there are some really great things that I think that, you know, it'd be really interesting to see. I would love to see, you know, professional fighters start to explore that a little bit. But the issue is that to even get remotely efficient at those kinds of things, it takes at least 10 years of like daily practice.
Yeah.
Right. And so that might be the challenge. By then your career is over.
It's a time budgeting issue. How old are you now?
36.
36. What advice would you give your 30-year-old self if you could place us where you were and what you were doing at that time?
I think it would be to, take a step back, right? Take a step back, really slow down and really think through what really, you know, matters in the long run, right? Because we're, you know, a
and
lot
what
of times.
Were you, this is, what were you doing at the time when you were so 30?
Well, but, well, my, but I guess that actually my 30 year old self, that's different because that's when I just started Saison.
Yeah.
So I was doing the same thing I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. Only in a more kind of, ridiculous way. But, I mean, my 20 year old self, 25 year old self.
Sure. Let's do, it. Let's
yeah.
do 25.
Yeah. You know, 25 year old self. Yeah. I mean, I think it would be to just really take a step back and not get caught up in anything stupid because, you know, a lot of times when we're chasing success or what we think is success, like trying to, as a chef, you want to build a big name. You want to, you know, get 3 Michelin stars. You want to get the accolades. But ultimately none of that shit matters. It matters in the beginning and it certainly matters along the way. But if we all just take a step back and I think there's, a bigger lesson to be learned for the way that we operate as a society is to really focus on what really matters to us and is what is genuinely makes us happy. Then we'll travel down the right path, right? And we won't get sidetracked by, you know, tits and ass or, whatever you, you know, fame and sports cars and all silly shit that you don't need.
Yeah.
And,
unless those are the things that really make you happy.
Well, I mean, look, cup two of those three. Do make us happy, but they're, but I mean that, you know, if what really makes you happy is getting in the woods,
yep.
then, you know, you focus, you're able to really take a step back and focus on quality. Maybe if you want to be a cook, you want to be a chef, what kind of chef do you want to be? You want to be an Instagram chef or you want to be a, you know, a chef with real quality and skill that's respectable, you know, respected by the world, you know, for your ethos or something. So just, you know, I would say, get your head out of your ass. Probably that would be my summary.
What were you distracted by or focusing on at 25 that you shouldn't have been?
all right. Oh, my parents-in-law don't hear this.
No, it's just like 2 people listen to this podcast. You're fine.
Yeah. I mean, I was just cooking. I was a chef at a restaurant called Chez TJ. The place in Mountain View.
Yeah, sure.
It's been there for like 30 years. I shortly after that got poached by, Michael Mina to do some development work. I opened a restaurant for him down in the St. Regis in Orange County, as a temporary gig and then went to work with him on kind of just to learn business from him, right? I wanted to learn some business. I didn't know anything about business at all. And I wanted to see kind of how that, operated and functioned as a restaurant group. So a lot of it was like Vegas and partying all the time and just ridiculousness. I mean, we would go out after work, and go home at sunrise and wake up at 4 p.m. and go back to like the kitchen the next day and just immediately need like a whiskey because you're so hungover. It was the only
hair of the dog. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was a good few years of my life, just kind of going crazy.
Mm-hmm. And
because I wasn't, all I did was train. So I didn't do that when I was younger. Like I had a period in my teenage years where I was a lunatic and then I went back into training around 15 and pulled out of that. And then I didn't really even drink until I was 25, after I got my chef's job. And so, you know, just a couple of makeups for lost time.
Yeah. I feel like oftentimes reflecting back on my high school career and college experience that if I had not had competitive sports, I mean, I would have ended up in Skid Row or in a gutter, or God knows where.
Oh, for sure. If I didn't have martial arts, I'd be dead in a gutter. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Where would you like to have food that you have not yet had food?
The exciting food to me is, you know, the original peoples of wherever, whatever location. So if we go to, Australia and have some Aboriginal traditional food and kind of explore that side of things in nature and the same thing with anywhere else. So if you go to any country or any place and kind of, you know, exploring the natural foods that existed before, commodification took place. That's what's very interesting to me.
I was playing with, had a lot of fun messing around with it. There's a guy named Cliff Hodges who's also in the 4-Hour Chef. He makes his own bows and arrows, like from scratch, and has hunted black bear with his, his, I guess they're Osage bows, I want to say. They're incredible. But, he introduced me to cooking on fire. So he is a outdoor survival expert, and taught me how to build debris huts and whatnot, knows how to track. Really interesting guy. You'd get a kick out of him. Lives in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And he, where was I going with this? Oh, he introduced me to acorn meal and making things out of acorns, which I looked into it at one point. It represented for certain indigenous North American tribes a substantial portion of their total calories. Acorns.
Yeah.
And I got really, got really interested in leaching acorns and making things out of acorn
flour. They're delicious.
Yeah.
Acorns are delicious.
Yeah. Really, really good.
I mean, that's the thing about our foodstuffs now is that there's so many amazing things. And that's kind of what Saison does at the moment is that we're, you know, it's just exploring what's here, the native foods. I mean, what exists really at a really, you know, incredible, quality. And, there's all kinds of shit here. We set up a program with fishermen where we get only live fish in our tanks, right? They bring us fish that's alive or we don't want it. And, that way we can kill it a certain way, the Kijime, and control the process. And same thing with like all the commercial fisheries, or the vegetables, the produce. We have wild kiwis in the woods of Marin. There's
wild kiwis.
Yeah. I mean, there's acorns, there's ginseng root growing, there's, berries, there's all kinds of crazy shit around. There's, diamond turbo in the waters here. There's pink scallops, there's monkey face eels. So we're exploring.
Those are some kind of funky looking things, man.
And they're really delicious too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like you just cook it. Let's say you cooked it like unagi or something, right? Yeah. It's delicious. Yeah. So there's all these amazing things around in each location around the country. And the Pacific happens to be amazing because of the ocean, but the cold climate of the ocean. But, that's a very exciting kind of food, right? To just really kind of look at what's around us, like really explore what's around us. It's nothing new. It's been done. It was being done before all this other shit was being done. And so, but that's really where great food comes from. Great food comes from not from growing it on a farm, but from really exploring the wild and finding, you know, that kind of reference point for flavor, right? Like you find the best, fish during the best season or the best, bear after eating the blueberries. During the right, you know, so there's all these, and the same thing with produce and all that other stuff. So that's a very exciting, exciting way to cook. Pretty soon I'm going to have a restaurant that only does that. It's going to take 6 hours to get to. And, maybe I'll just do it for one table night. And, maybe you're part of the hunting process. Who knows? Or, you know, go out and catch our trout.
I'm in. Yeah. If you need a guinea pig.
Yeah.
To take it for a test drive. Count me in. This makes me think a little bit of an experiment that you did. I'm not sure how recently this was, but the chef's table, rotation that you did with, help me out with the name here. Jiro.
Jiro, yeah.
But not the Jiro that people would associate.
Not Sugibashi Jiro. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But Jiro who was cooking, I guess, previously in Noe Valley. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. He was trained in Tokyo. He was a sushi chef in Tokyo. I love his sushi. He has that timing. You know, he has a sensibility to the flavor of his sushi. And unfortunately in San Francisco, there's no good sushi at all. And, I really wish there were, but there isn't. And, so that's why I fell in love with his sushi because it was so delicious. Had the rice was a little warmer, had the right texture. The thickness of the cuts of the fish, the direction in which you cut against the grain or with the grain, the balance of the seasoning, just everything was there.
And so for a period of time, I don't know how long it was, but he, would seat how many people per night?
Eight people. Yeah. So I built this little, for those who don't know, I built this little, chef's counter out next to Saison. And, it was, or behind Saison. And it was, 8 seats and, there were no turns. There was no real, commodity to the situation, I guess. You know,
no turns meaning somebody wouldn't get up and get replaced by another diner.
Right. Exactly. And in today's real estate, for the cost of renting a place, paying for labor, you know, all these other things, insurances and taxes and all that shit, you have to do more than one seating, right? You have to, you know, get as many people in there as you can, which is a very sad state of restaurants. Especially when you're trying to, you know, do things that are really amazing or give people a great experience. So this was just a little 8-seat workshop, essentially. And so he cooked in there for a little while. We would do some collaboration dinners. And it was really great. But then I realized we're still in the city and you know, there's only so much you can do on a busy street with a dump truck driving by, you know, so I've been working on, some new stuff and one day I'll be able to tell you about it.
And why the 80s music? You always have great 80s music playing, at least in my experience so far. Yeah.
Fun. It's a restaurant that's in the, it's pleasure. It's about pleasure. It's about enjoyment. It's about people coming in. I know not everybody's going to like 80 music, but the substantial majority of our subset of diners that come in, like, you know, that kind of, 80 music and it's just fun.
Yeah.
That's the only reason. It's just about fun.
Speaking of fun, Molly just got Chester's Bubba. So Chester is going to have playmate here. There she is. Ooh, tail smashing the cups. We almost went for a yard sale with the cups.
Yeah, so it's really just about the whole reasoning of Saison was about the essential nature of a hospitality experience. The food being what we talked about earlier, the 80s music being fun, you know, the things you pick up in your hands feeling good, the seat being comfortable, the service being warm and real. You know, so that's kind of why the 80s music came about.
Well, what I love about the 80s music.
And plus when you have a couple glasses of wine and you can cook.
Well, I was going to say that I've taken a few friends to Saison and, they've always had questions about the 80s music. And then they get a few dishes in, maybe a glass or two of wine. And they're like, you know, this music's perfect. I really think this music is extremely suiting to this experience. And, I always have to ask people because I've been in San Francisco for so long and I get questions about places to go to eat. And I always have to ask, you know, what's your budget and what's the occasion? Because Saison's, you know, it's a higher end. Higher end, I mean, I'm grasping for a better adjective.
It's expensive.
It's an expensive.
Comparatively to other places,
It's a comparatively expensive place, but for an anniversary or something like that, or just a special experience, I think it's always been my go-to. Yeah. On the opposite end of the spectrum, if I'm like, if you want a really filthy, delicious burrito in the Mission, then I think El Farolito, if you want to like also have a conversation with a couple of meth heads, then that is the spot to go.
It's my preferred choice of meal conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And, our dogs are playing, folks. But, so Joshua, we could keep talking forever. Where can people find you online on the socials? Learn more about what you're up to. I think your Instagram is fantastic. Also, if you want to see a lot of very, very peculiar and delicious ingredients, then that's a good place to see you. But where can people find you?
Yeah, Instagram is Jace Gaines, JSKENES. Almost forgot my own spot there. Jace Gaines on Instagram. Or on Twitter, I think it's SaisonSF.
SaisonSF. And the website also is
SaisonSF.com.
And I will put all this in the show notes, folks, including links to anything that we might have mentioned. Our dogs are having a blast. Speaking of joy. So you can find the show notes at 4hourworkweek.com/podcast. Josh, thanks for taking the time, man.
Thanks for having me here, man. It's exciting. Let's go hunting now.
Let's go hunting and have some wine, in that order. And, to everybody listening, we're going to play with the dogs. And until next time, thank you for listening. Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is Five Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And Five Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.